This episode sponsored by The New Press, publisher of The New World We Need, stories and lessons from America's unsung environmental movement, defending homes, strengthening communities, restoring the land. The World We Need offers a vivid look at the people protecting America's communities against environmental degradation and racism. Visit theworldweneed.com to find out how you can help. Welcome to the Harper's Podcast. My name is Violet Luca, and I'm the web editor. Popular histories, regardless of subject, tend to share the same historical fallacies, an overemphasis on and oversimplification of particular people and events that squeeze out other, more subtle factors of change, or just don't fit into the author's ideology. It's clear what beliefs drive John Meacham's latest book, The Soul of America. The American experiment, though marred by universally condemned sins like slavery, is fundamentally good, and the office of the president brings out the best in the men who occupy it. In the July issue, Thomas Frank reviews Meacham's latest book and the HBO documentary that's based upon it. I spoke with Frank about what's missing from Meacham's approach, Meacham's connections to President Biden, and how our understanding of the present is limited by the decimation of non-coastal journalism. We're recording this the day after Donald Rumsfeld, who was once named sexiest cabinet member by People magazine in 2002, died. And it seems like every outlet is trying to outdo each other with headlines. I mean, I got an email that said, Donald Rumsfeld, rotten hell, from a certain publication. You could probably, it was Jackman, not surprising. But I guess, what was your reaction to his death? I mean, he certainly undermines this great man theory of history, or at least the idea that the president is the only important person in U.S. government that matters.
I don't know about that. I think Rumsfeld would have been one of those people that didn't the Bush administration generate this theory of the presidency where the executive was like the only thing that mattered? I remember, what was it called? The unitary executive theory. Do you remember
yes,
this?
That's right. Yes.
But look, I was obviously that was a really a bad period for me. You know, I remember when I knew the Iraq War was coming, and it was I forget how long after 9/11, but they were, you know, they were pushing this idea that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. And I remember a cover of, I think it was the Atlantic magazine, that showed Saddam Hussein with blood on his hands. And I knew at that moment that this is where it was all going, and that they were going to get us in a war with Iraq, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And it was extremely frustrating, extremely frustrating. You want to know a funny fact about that? At the time, so I lived in Hyde Park, which is a neighborhood in Chicago, and my state senator was a guy called Barack Obama, and it's a very liberal part of Chicago. And I was pissed off about this, and when the war got going, I was pissed off about it, and all my friends were pissed off about it, and they held an anti-war rally, and Barack Obama spoke at it. And that was basically, that set up the sort of dynamic that later made him president, because you recall he was the only guy running in 2008 in the Democratic primaries who had a legitimate claim to have opposed the Iraq war. Yeah. So anyhow, but yeah, Rummy, I mean, all those people were just such tremendous jerks. But it's, you know, what I've been thinking about lately is not so much the Bush administration, but the sort of incredible revulsion against the Trump administration, which actually allowed a lot of members of the Bush administration to rehabilitate themselves. Now right. not Rumsfeld himself. I don't recall hearing of any of him doing anything during the Trump years, but so many other
Ari Fleischer.
I was thinking of David Frum.
Oh yeah, him too. Ugh.
And so many more. You know, all of these people who essentially endorsed that stuff and were able to completely rehabilitate themselves just because they, you know, they disliked Donald Trump. So,
or, you know, they were more polite. They're more suave in their well, I don't know. It's hard for me, because there would be so many people who would be like, "Oh, Donald Trump is the worst president." And I'm like, George W. Bush.
Yeah, I was going to say Trump.
George W. Bush really took, he has a long way to go before he hits Bush.
Well, they're judging by different standards. They're judging by the Meacham standards, which are, you know, his vulgarity, his lack of respect for the office. Come on, what are the buzzwords? What are the keywords here? It's stuff that I never think about myself, but that you know, everybody else talks about all the time. Temperament, character. Decency, you know.
Yes,
and if you judge George W. Bush by those standards, you know, he wasn't that bad. He always wore a tie in the Oval Office. He didn't have sex with an intern, you know, so he invaded a country under false pretenses. So he had allowed industries like Wall Street to regulate them, to police themselves, and it ended in disaster, you know. So what? He was, at least he didn't curse on TV.
That's right. That's right. A little, you know, what are children supposed to think? But I mean, because I would say, you know, you write this review of John Meacham's book and this HBO documentary that shares the title with the book, The Soul of America. And it seems like kind of an easy swipe because, you know, Thomas Frank excoriating this goober who kind of speaks in these meaningless platitudes and espouses historical facts that everyone can agree on, you know, the good and the bad. But as you know,
sometimes a lot of the stuff he says is really tendentious, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll get to that. But I mean, the just the idea that you would take on somebody like Meacham, as you note in the piece, John Meacham is very close to President Biden.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that connection?
Yeah. So I don't see it as taking on an easy target at all, because this guy is an important public intellectual. His books are widely read. He wins all kinds of prizes. He's got the Pulitzer Prize. Oprah loves him, you know, on and on and on. He's on TV constantly. We did the math. MSNBC, he was on something like 500 times in the course of the Trump administration. And his magnum opus, The Soul of America, in which he sort of pulled all his ideas together and tried to generate a theory of American history. This was swiped. The title of it was basically swiped by Joe Biden in his run for the presidency. It became Joe Biden's slogan, you know, a battle for the soul of America. Biden did openly acknowledge that. It wasn't like Biden was doing this surreptitiously. Biden is very close with Meacham. Meacham meets with Biden in the White House. You know, Meacham whispers in the president's ear. He is as close to a powerful intellectual as this country has. And so it's not like taking on an easy target. This is like really important, this guy. What this guy thinks and says is very important.
And I guess how would you characterize what he's saying and how he is characterizing not just America, but what liberalism is?
Well, I don't think of John Meacham as a liberal. I would have never called him a liberal until recently. But the fact remains, it is Joe Biden, the Democratic president and the Democratic candidate for president a few years ago. That's who is embracing him. It's, you know, Meacham is on MSNBC all the time, you know, which is the liberal network. But it wasn't all that long ago that Meacham was, you know, I would have never thought of this guy as a Democrat or as a liberal, because he was this huge fan of Ronald Reagan, who sort of defines modern conservatism. Meacham wrote a lengthy and admiring biography. And by the way, not a bad book. He's pretty good at the sort of biographical stuff. He wrote a biography of George H.W. Bush, you know, George Bush Sr., spoke at George Bush's funeral a few years ago, you know, and then that's just talking about Republicans on the sort of economic conservatism, he's always been right there for the Republican Party. I remember when he was editor of Newsweek, he did a cover story when George Bush the second was president, and they had bailed out Wall Street. This is in during the financial crisis, and I think after the election, but before Barack Obama had become president. And he said that that was the cover story that he wrote was, "We are all socialists now," describing the bailouts of Wall Street as an act of socialism. And it's like, that's tough. That's hard to take for someone like me.
Yeah. In, you know, the documentary where it's sort of structured around, it's sort of this loose introduction to him. You have this, you know, great man music. You have him saying these wonderful things about America, but also kind of a little critical things about America that everyone can agree on. And, you know, it's clearly a response to Donald Trump. And it's interesting to watch that now.
Yes.
Post-Trump and in the Biden era.
Yes. You know, it's been a long time in this country since you had historians that were able to uncritically celebrate America. That you'd have to go back quite a ways in order to find that sort of history. But what Meacham does is he says, you know, America has a good side. I'm sorry. It's like there's something so simplistic about it that it's hard to take it seriously. But basically, the idea is that in the soul of America, you have a good side and you have a bad side.
Wow. I know you have the duality of man.
So there are good forces in history and there are bad forces in history. And the job of the historian, it's not so much to define which is which. He takes all that for granted. We already know before we open his books which is which. There's nothing really challenging there, like saying, you know, all the stuff that you think is good, you know, we're gonna challenge that. We're gonna say, no, maybe a lot of it is actually bad, which is classically what intellectuals do, but that's not what Meacham does. His job is just to celebrate the good and denounce the bad, and not to like redefine them or anything like that. We all know what the bad is. Can you guess what's bad? Right. What's bad, Violet? What's bad in American history?
Slavery?
Yes.
Segregation. Japanese internment?
Yes. 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 McCarthyism.
Well, that's bad.
This is like they enumerate these and
yes.
So it's like racism is bad. Yes. Sexism is bad. And red scares are bad. And that's about it.
Yeah, I mean it seems so interesting and unchallenging, and perhaps this is why he is so widely popular, because it is kind of a refresher of things you probably remember from high school history class.
This is more simple than that. At least in high school history class, you would like get into some of the complexities of around these issues, you know. But that's not done here. The role of the historian is to celebrate the good and to denounce the wicked. And that's it. And just to do that again and again and again. And, you know, these completely ordinary observations nailed down with completely familiar quotations that you saw in like Ken Burns' documentary. Or you remember like the Army McCarthy hearings when the lawyer for the Army says to McCarthy, "At long last, have you no decency, sir?" Yeah, it's like oh, let's quote that again. It's always the most familiar quotes. The most famous quotes arrayed to support the most non-controversial observations, like, you know, McCarthyism was a bad thing.
Right. I mean, it feels kind of like a cheat almost, because, you know, one of the easiest ways to fill out pages in, say, a term paper or meet word count on an article is to just, you know, insert quotes by other people that you know are great. And so you don't have to write as much or introduce your own ideas as much. And because these quotes tend to be long, it's better than whatever you could possibly generate. And
let's be fair. So I did study history once upon a time. That was going to be I had intended to be a historian earlier in life. And that is what historians do, but they do that for legitimate reasons. You want to be exposed to the original words. you know, the idea is to understand what people actually said in the past. So,
of course, yeah. But I mean, when it's something like, oh, are better angels.
Yeah. I know. Don't you love that concept? And wait, and the only reason that is like, that we're supposed to take that seriously, or that we're supposed to think that's like a real category or a real way of thinking about things, is because Abraham Lincoln said it.
And, right.
And wait, Violet. I don't know if you're aware of this. Abraham Lincoln was the president of the United States.
Wow. Yeah, and that, wow, I think I remember reading that.
Violet, that, like, presidents are, like, really important.
They're really important guys. Yeah. No, we live in a pretty cool country. I don't know if it's pretty cool. The American experiment is pretty great. And I mean,
Wait. I don't know if you understand this, though. I don't think you've really looked at this all the way.
We need to go this
way. Violet, there have been good presidents and there have been bad ones.
Wow. Go on. Yes. Take my money.
He actually does have an interesting theory in here somewhere, which is that, and this is original with Meacham. I've never seen anybody else argue it. Well, maybe somebody has. I don't know. That the presidency is, the office has a magnetic attraction to the good. Yes, which I had never heard that one before. But, you know, you'd arguably say, well, we're not, you know, to become president, you have to go through this long political career. You have to do all these things. You can't really be like, you know, a bank robber and become president. You know, I mean, Trump is about as close as we've ever got.
Right. Yeah.
but, you know, ordinarily, you know, it's just like they aren't people who deal in wickedness, the guys who are elected president. You know, they all go to church, and again, with a few exceptions, they like us to think that they're good people. So it's not that remarkable, but that is Meacham's theory, is that presidents are magnetically drawn to the power of the good, and he shows presidents who seem to become better people once they are elected to the presidency. Although, you know, he doesn't go into great detail on these people, so it's not clear that what really happened or anything like that. But that's his theory.
Right. Because the way he is presented in the documentary, and, you know, he's like this kind of little dorky, sweet sounding Southern man, you know, older, kind of reassuring.
He's younger than me.
I know. I swear he makes himself look older on purpose to have like that grandpa feeling. Like, it's all part of this theory. But specifically, I'm asking because he seems to be this so popular because he's an exemplar of liberal patriotism, which has different features, or at least pretends to have different features, from conservative patriotism. And I was wondering if you could...
You're going to have to tell me what you mean by that.
Just that, you know, he's... a conservative patriotism is that America is always good. Right?
Yeah.
And that this liberal patriotism...
But no, that even conservatives acknowledge the bad chapters.
They have started. Yes. There's no more lost cause theory going around.
Yeah,
like that's over.
That's dead. I don't know of any historians anymore who argue any version, any iteration of that. You know, that stuff is completely gone. But I'm thinking of someone like, so the guy that Meacham reminded me of most, and maybe this is a little unfair, but he reminded me of Glenn Beck.
Okay, yeah.
Glenn Beck was this kind of very important figure in the early Obama years. Remember, he had a TV
yes.
show on Fox News. He would cry. Do you remember that?
And of course, the chart.
Yes, the chalkboard. he once put,
yes.
unless I dreamed it, I think Beck once put me up on the chalkboard. You know,
oh my gosh. Congratulations.
Yeah. But Beck was similarly obsessed with presidents, especially the founders, right? Beck was really, really, really concerned with the founders and would do these close readings of their texts, of their speeches and their writings and stuff like that. And, you know, he understood history via the presidency, but he was also obsessed with good and evil. So Beck would always say, you know, we've had good chapters in our history and we've had bad, or whatever his terms were for that. But this is really not a... controversial or innovative, way of looking at the past. It's incredibly commonplace. And I think of Beck as a conservative. Now, the difference is Beck was singularly obsessed with Barack Obama as an evil actor, right. Which is just seems so weird to me. But that's what he was. And Meacham was obsessed with Donald Trump as a wicked actor.
Right. And I mean, even there's even a pretty funny moment late in the documentary where Meacham is praising H.W. Bush for not sort of like dancing over the grave of the Berlin Wall. And he says, you know, because H.W. knew that Gorbachev had this extreme right wing who were very patriotic, one of whom included a young KGB agent named Vladimir Putin.
Oh, like, look out. Yeah. That guy's going to come and get you.
Literally, this is how long this game has been going for Vladimir Putin. He's been planning this. This obsession with who's good, who's evil, and their ability to exert power over these things. That there are many factors coming into this, and it's a very limited histographical approach, right?
Yeah. Well, look. I don't want to present myself as some kind of authority on the currents in American historiography. I don't follow it anymore. I used to study it, but I don't anymore. But I'm here to tell you what I did study it. Nobody did great man history like this anymore. What you studied right. were social movements, that's what fascinated me. I mean, there are two things that were in vogue when I was in history. One was studying sort of social movements, what we call social history, the history of ordinary people and how they lived their lives and how that changed. And then the history of ideas, what we call intellectual history. And I was in love with both of those fields. But the idea of just like doing history through the prism of presidents, I mean, it's just so it's not just a throwback. It's like, I don't even know when that was in vogue. I guess like the turn of the century, of the last century or something. It's like Thomas Carlyle. What was Carlyle's title? It's heroes and hero worship through history. That's the classic text of what they used to call great man history, where it's all about like Napoleon and his genius, and Napoleon outsmarts everybody else. And he is the smartest man in all of Europe. And he does all these great things on the international stage. And then you've got another hero that's great man history. But that's what this is. It's kind of a curious throwback.
Yes. I mean, I think you could argue that it's fulfilling this psychic need in that, so much stuff is changing so quickly. And there are these incredible social movements, which are visually referenced. Well, the suffragists are mentioned.
Yeah, oh, no, that's right.
And then
yes.
compared to the Women's March, which seems like a very apples and oranges sort of thing, where it's like the Women's March, it was a great statement, but there wasn't an underlying praxis there.
There was no movement.
Yeah, there was no movement. It was a statement. And the suffragists were fighting, being force-fed in prison and undergoing like really alienating, horrific experiences. And
women's suffrage also was a movement that was around for a very long time before they finally achieved victory. And that's important to remember. These are, that was a long-standing social movement. But look, it goes with where we are today. So I'm speaking to you from Kansas City, where I'm visiting members of my family. Kansas City is a city of the metro area is a city of 2 million people. And the local newspaper is just about dead. It's been shrinking and shrinking for years. It still exists. It's not out of business yet, but it's been changing hands from one owner to another. They had to sell their office building. The news section is down to, it's very, very small. And this is the kind of city where, they're not going to know about what you're doing unless you tell them, right? If your company is based here and you're doing something, the newspaper isn't going to find out about it unless you call them up and tell them. They just don't have that capacity anymore. And so the idea of actually reporting on the lives of ordinary people and understanding like society, which is what history used to be interested in. That is something that has become increasingly foreign to us. I mean, the only newspapers that are left in this country are based in New York or Washington. I mean, the ones that have any life to them. I mean, you have an LA Times and a Chicago Tribune, but again, they are shadows of their former selves. And as a nation, I think, especially as liberals, we focus on top down everything. Everything, because that's all we understand. We also, liberalism has changed now in our lifetimes. When I was young, I was taught and I believed and I understood, because it was incredibly obvious, that liberalism was the sort of political formation of working class people. It was liberalism right. was about the bettering the conditions of ordinary people in their lives. And today, liberalism is about rich people sort of scolding everybody else, rich people being better people than everybody else. Liberalism is identified with these affluent parts of America. I mean, that whole working class side of it is disappearing before our eyes. I mean, it still exists in some ways, but Meacham is a symptom of that. You know, this focus on the presidency. Because that really is how we that's how liberals understand their world now, is this top down thing, and his whole idea that power. Do you remember the old saying that power corrupts?
Yes.
Well, for Meacham, it doesn't. Power ennobles. When right. someone becomes president, they become a better person. The office has that sort of magnetic power over them, and that's kind of what we believe as liberals. You think of Hillary Clinton boasting about carrying the wealthiest parts of America, the parts that are vital and vibrant and moving forward and more tolerant and more diverse. We just understand liberalism is a philosophy of the better people, the more powerful people, the wealthier people, because
the enlightened people.
Exactly. That's the word. And so Meacham fits with that, I think, in a way.
Yeah. I mean, obviously what you're describing is partially politics is theater, another great old saying that is more or less true. And it's when the Tea Party first got in, that first wave of politicians got in during the Obama era, they made a big deal of reading the Constitution.
Yes, you remember that.
As a biz performance.
Yeah, yeah. They would have backyard parties where you were supposed to.
Yes. It was ridiculous. But then when Trump was in office, the Democrats did the same thing.
Yeah.
And so it's this theater that's inherent to politics, but both parties are fundamentally invested in holding this document and saying, this is actually our document, number one. And then number two, they're interested not necessarily in, fixing climate change or addressing the evils of capitalism, but this self-perpetuation. And it's this sort of critique is absent in both, it's absent in center-right histories, to say the least. It's increasingly absent in a lot of histories.
What critique are you talking about? The critique of capitalism.
The critique of, okay. And also the of environmental collapse. Like, we're facing environmental collapse. Like, it was 18 degrees Celsius in the Antarctic today. Like, this is something that everyone should be acting
so
on.
So, Violet, I don't know what you're talking about. It's like room temperature in Kansas City. usually the summers here are really steamy and hot, and this year it's not, so I'm not worried. I was trying to explain global warming to my I don't want to go there. Let's stick to so environmental history is a relatively new thing. So that was when I was in history graduate school in the late 80s and early 90s. I don't recall anybody studying that, but they may have been. People were doing the history of science, which is absolutely fascinating, but we'll talk about that's not I don't want to get into that right now. Now there are people who are doing what Meacham is doing. This is an old sort of genre in history, the grand sweeping history of progress.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the triumph of good over bad, or the struggle of good and bad all throughout American history. And there's many examples of this. And they tend to be books about the history of liberalism. They tend to be written by liberals, and they tend to be histories of liberalism. And there's one that that his book made me think of, and I went and pulled it off the shelf, and it's called Rendezvous with Destiny. Written by Eric Goldman. And Rendezvous with Destiny is a famous line from a speech by Franklin Roosevelt. You know, this generation has a rendezvous with destiny. And I think that was in 1936 he gave. It's one of my favorite Roosevelt lines. But Eric Goldman was, it was a one of the classic histories of liberalism. Eric Goldman, by the way, was a public intellectual in his day, a serious historian, but also was on TV a lot, wrote for popular magazines, was an advisor to Lyndon Johnson. And he takes the title, like Meacham, he takes the title of his book from a speech by a president, in this case, Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt, whom he regards as the climactic figure in the sort of struggle for liberalism and for justice in American history. Okay, so I compared the two books, and there's lots of similarities. You know, these are two books trying to do the same thing: Meacham's Soul of America and Goldman's Rendezvous with Destiny. And Goldman hits all the same notes that Meacham does. He talks about the struggle against racism. He talks about the fight for women's suffrage. He, although his book was published in 52 and McCarthyism was actually still going when he wrote the book, he denounces McCarthyism in it, and he denounces Red Scares in general. So all of the themes in Meacham's book are present. But what's really interesting is that Goldman has, that's just a small part of his book. The overwhelming majority of it is concerned with something completely different that Meacham barely even talks about, which is the struggle for economic democracy, or the, how would you say, the problems of capitalism, you know, exploitation, pollution, millions of people working for nothing, the struggle of farmers and workers to come together and to try to tame capitalism. This is the great sweeping narrative that Goldman tells, and it's that is his generation, again, writing in 1952, Harry Truman was president. This was his generation's understanding of the grand sweep of American history, and it's when he's writing it, America is literally at it's a high point. You know, we've achieved progress in all of these wonderful ways. You know, Eisenhower has not yet come in. Truman has, you know, has basically, the New Deal is complete except for healthcare, and Truman was not able to get healthcare done. But desegregation of the armed forces is underway. So the New Deal has been, is committed to civil rights at this point in 1952. You know, not fully, but it's that is well underway, and so it's kind of a triumphant take on American history. What's funny is all of that economic stuff is missing from Meacham's account. It's just not there. It's completely forgotten. And I sometimes think, Violet, I wake up and I'm like, did I dream all this? You know, didn't liberals used to care about these things? And we never talk about them anymore. Like organized labor, like agrarian radicalism, like the struggle to stop, you know, monopolies. You know, Standard Oil. Did I just dream all that? I mean, because no one ever talks about it anymore. It's as though it has disappeared from the conversation. It's like it was never even there.
Right. No, and I mean, this is actually something that I was kind of trying to get at before when talking about how Meacham performs authority and sounds authoritative, even though he's peddling very basic stuff, is that, you know, He's not talking to you like a Bernie Sanders with this intense passion and citing things like economic injustice, environmental problems. Like, he's just sort of, you know, he has this very calm but authoritative voice, and he's leading you through history, and he's telling you at the end of the day, everything's gonna be fine.
Right. Yes. And that's very comforting. And I think that was actually I think that was a good thing for him to be doing during the Trump years, because there was a lot of hysteria and anything that I don't disagree with him on that, by the way, anything you can do to keep that hysteria in check, I think was wise. But what's weird is the deletion of this, of the struggle for economic justice from the story of liberalism. And I don't want to, I want to be real clear about this. Meacham doesn't just delete it. You know, he barely talks about it at all. He goes the other way. For Meacham, the big villain, and you have to really sort of drill down and read between the lines and read, not read between the lines, but do a close reading of the book to understand this. economic discontent is the villain in his telling of American history. Now, that's new, okay? That is new, especially for liberals, especially in this kind of genre that we're talking about, the grand sweeping narrative of American progress, you know, which, like I said before, is a historical favorite. Historians love to write books like this. But for him, economic discontent is, there's something suspicious about it. There's something wrong with it. It's always leading people astray. And he had these, you know, there's these very curious takes that he offers on U.S. history, where he describes the Ku Klux Klan as kind of a white working class organization. This is not something I had heard before. He describes it as a kind of like something like a labor union, which I'd never, you know, that's kind of interesting. And then he describes Trumpism as a result of economic anxiety, but not economic anxiety, full stop, economic anxiety, which leads to racism, which leads to Trumpism. So in his mind, economic anxiety seems to be a kind of threshold to racism. This happens again and again and again in his account of U.S. history. Economic anxiety and racism seem to go hand in hand. Whereas for another generation of historians, economic anxiety was what would often lead to progress, you know, to organized labor coming together, to the populists coming together, to, you know, you name it, right up through the 1960s, economic anxiety is what gives you change. But for Meacham and this is not just Meacham, by the way, this is a lot of liberals now would agree with this. Economic anxiety is something suspicious. It's something to be concerned about because it leads people to Trumpism.
Right. Because they're just not as well read.
Well, they don't understand globalization, Violet.
Yeah,
you know, they don't understand that this is all, you know, they can't see the bigger picture. By the way, which was an argument that has always been used against working class organizations, always since the beginning of, you know, I wrote a book about populism last year, and that's that exact argument was used against the populists, that these stupid farmers in Kansas, they just could not understand global wheat markets or something like that. And they, you know, so therefore they had no right to be asking for the reforms that they were asking for, you know.
Well, the book and the documentary very much tied to and a response to 4 years of Trump, which again, no matter how good or bad any president is, they have at least 4 years unless they die.
Yeah.
Like it's really like no matter how bleak things are, it's not necessarily going to last that long. And so now that we're in the Biden era and Biden made all these promises that within the first 100 days, I will do this, 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 this. And now that we're past those first 100 days, speaking of time, it doesn't seem like a whole lot is happening and that there are still a lot of children in detention camps along the southern border. And there's still a lot of things that, you know, the death penalty has not been abolished. There's a lot of things that are not happening that seem like there's a lot of things
that would abolishing the death penalty would be a long reach for someone like Biden.
He said he was going to do it. He said he was going to do it. All right.
Biden said he was going to abolish the death
federal death penalty.
Biden is one of the guys that like supported the federal death penalty. If you go back and look at the crime bill of 1994, that's
he flipped. He flipped. Oh, did he? For this election, yeah. Because, I mean, just like, I mean, this is my thing with Meacham. It's like he clearly is tailoring himself and his history to the times in which we live, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
we are living during these times where there's a lot more activism, a lot more people are upset. People are voicing their critiques of these existing systems. And so this book is kind of a gentle reflection of that, but not going very deep. And so with Biden, he did the same thing, right? Where he posited himself as perhaps a more a little further left than he actually is. So I guess how do you see the rest of Biden's perhaps 4 to 8 years turning out? Because it seems like, you know, the Obama years there was a lot of stasis.
Right. So I have to tell you, you know, I've commented on this for a lot of different podcasts and stuff like that. And it's just like I get so much shit for saying anything nice about Biden, But I have to be try to be fair. Okay, so let's say something nice about him, and then I'll go to the disappointments. But Biden's economic team has left austerity in the dust. And I am really happy to see that. Austerity being, of course, the sort of doctrine of the Obama years and before, that you have to be responsible. You can't let the deficit get too out of control. And I love that the Biden people have they just don't care about that anymore. I'm not talking about Biden himself here. I mean, who the hell, this guy was the biggest deficit hawk for his entire career in the U.S. Senate. And now he just doesn't seem to care about it anymore. And that is a welcome development. Let's not poo-poo that. That's good. I'm really glad that's happening. And I have to say, the biggest challenge facing us right now is to keep Donald Trump or someone like Trump from being elected president again. And the way you do that is you make yourself extremely popular. You go out and you appeal to these people that voted for Trump and you win them over. And that's not hard to do. I mean, we know who those people are. We know what they're upset about. You know, it's I've been writing about this my entire career. It's generally speaking, it's the white working class. These are people that are watching their lives deteriorate. There's all sorts of ways a really vigorous liberal president, a kind of Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson style president, could win those voters back. It wouldn't even be hard. Let me put it that way. It would be hard, however, if you're not willing to challenge your own party and you're not willing to, you know, his majority in the U.S. Senate is extremely slim. If you're not willing to do away with the sort of technical rules like the filibuster, the frankly, just between you and me, undemocratic rules I am not a big fan of the filibuster, and Biden has a majority. He should be able to use it. He should be able to get what needs to be done. And if he wants bipartisanship, I don't even think that would be too hard. There's always one or two Republican votes that you can peel off, you know, with some classic Lyndon Johnson style log rolling. It's not a hard thing to do. But what you have to do is you have to have a vigorous program, you know, that you're going to help these people out. You're going to actually change their lives for the better. You have to know what you're doing, and you have to set about it in a really deliberate and forceful way. And that is clearly not happening. You know, I like that he got his big, that they're going to do something on infrastructure. The details of it are awful. I like that he wants to do these other big social spending bills, but he's basically confessing that he can't get it done unless they abolish the filibuster, and he's got no interest in anyhow. So look, what could he have done? First of all, the minimum wage, which he let a technicality trip him up on that.
Oh my God, I know, that's so dumb.
But there's all sorts of things that he could be doing. Antitrust is a big one, and they seem to be making baby steps in the right direction on that. But you want to talk about like what would help farmers, what would help small town America? These are places that are overwhelmingly Trump now. How do you bring those people back? These people used to be Democrats, or a lot of them did anyways. I'm here, like I said, I'm in Kansas City. Rural Missouri was once overwhelmingly Democratic. And that wasn't just because they were racist. You know, and then the party stopped being racist and they all abandoned it. That is not the entire story. There were people who were loyal, hardcore liberal Democrats in this state, or in the state of Missouri, I should say, up until fairly recently. And you can get them back, but you have to make a real, you know, you have to deliver what politicians are supposed to deliver. You have to improve the lives of ordinary people. And I don't see Biden. I think his economic team understands that that's what they need to do. I don't think they understand the urgency of it. And by the way, this is fascinating because we've just been told for 4 years that Donald Trump is the second coming of Hitler. And I'm not exaggerating there. There were people who said that. There were serious academics who said that Trump is Hitler. I've just finished a book making that very argument, written by a prestigious historian at like Yale or Princeton or somewhere like that. There's lots of people made that argument. Well, if you really think that, not only should you have done away with the filibuster by now, you should have like be doing everything in your power to making sure that that guy never comes back and that his party that his party gets badly punished for nominating people like Donald Trump. Well, you should be doing that with every fiber in your being if you sincerely think that's the case. They clearly don't. They clearly don't don't think that. They're just like, they're taking it easy in Washington, D.C., you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's this theater of this threat.
Oh, not only is it, I'm sorry, Violet, you got me going here. I want to get back to Meacham at some point, but they've already pulled off, you know, the old Green Lantern theory and dusted it off and are using it again. This is a theory for encouraging nothing. This is a theory of complacency where liberals say to imagine that the presidency has power. You follow me here? To imagine that the presidency has power is to think that the president is a superhero and like a Green Lantern comic book character. That's how dumb it is. And the liberals are already saying this again after they just told us that Trump was Hitler.
Yes, I know. It's like, well, wait, one of these is true. Which one of these is true? Either the president
has... They're both wrong. But Trump is bad enough. You know, that you don't want him coming back. You don't want anybody like him coming back. But at the same time, the president is not powerless. You know, there's all kinds of things that Joe Biden could do to improve life for ordinary Americans. You know, there's all kinds of things. But they're just, you know, look, I was never like optimistic about Joe Biden. During the primaries, I was a Sanders supporter. Biden fascinated me because of a lot of these Meacham things, because he was reassuring, he was grandfatherly, and there's a certain side of me that said, yeah, that's exactly what we need after this asshole, Donald Trump, you know, in the White House. We need a guy with civility and with, you know, gravitas, and we kind of need that. But that is not enough. Anybody can tell you that's not enough. That president also has to be Lyndon Johnson. That president also has to be Franklin Roosevelt. And there's no sign that Biden has any intention of doing those things. What's funny is Biden does know how it's done. He was in the Senate his entire career. Now, he's not there long enough to remember Lyndon Johnson, but he remembers a lot of guys like that. He remembers Robert Byrd, for God's sakes. You know, there's a long tradition of this in the U.S. Senate. He can get this shit done if he wants.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Violet. You got me going there.
Can we go back
to history here? Can we please?
Okay, well, let's go. So back to history, not the present. We're going back in time. I would be interested to hear more about Meacham's bibliography. In your review, you mentioned this book he did with the country music singer Tim McGraw about sort of like the Great American Songbook and how it sort of intersects with politics and his ideas about history.
Well, it's
the way popular history. Well, sorry, go ahead.
You just took the words out of my mouth. It's popular history. He's writing, you know, he's writing history for a mass audience. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, Violet. I write for the general public. I don't write for academics anymore. And I did that deliberately. You know, I did that on purpose. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can still have strong ideas and interesting ideas and new ideas, new interpretations, even if you're writing for the general public. But the idea that seems to be Meacham has two innovations. One is the idea that we talked about before of the presidents are magnetically drawn to the good. And the other is this idea that economic discontent is the bad guy of American history. It's kind of the villain of American history. And there's a really kind of shocking example of that in the book of protest songs. And it's a history of American songs, of popular songs in America, including a lot of protest songs. And the aspect of Meacham, so take a step back here. When you say that economic discontent is a problem in American history, that it's not on the side of the good, that it doesn't yield victories for liberalism, there's this huge counterexample, okay, which is the 1930s, which is the Franklin Roosevelt administration, which is earlier historians, in fact, sometimes I wonder if I dreamed all this. Up until very, very recently, Franklin Roosevelt was regarded as the great triumph of liberalism in America. And I, you know, sometimes I wake up and I'm like, I must be the only one that thought that, because no one says that anymore. But yes, he was. And the Roosevelt administration came out of I don't know if you ever heard of this. They had this thing called the Great Depression. Began with a stock market crash or something like 30% unemployment. You know, we were on the gold standard. people had to use barter. It was a terrible, terrible, awful time. My dad grew up then. He used to tell us stories about it. It was real bad. Okay. And Roosevelt, the great triumphant liberal president, came out of that. Okay, so economic discontent literally gave us the great liberal triumph in American history. And then Roosevelt got all kind. I sometimes think I dreamed this because nobody else talks about it anymore. Roosevelt did all these things. I don't know if you're aware of this. Like he regulated the stock market. He legalized labor unions. They set up all these relief agencies. You know, they helped out homeowners so that they didn't get foreclosed on. They
gave people jobs.
They gave people
all kinds of people.
They gave people jobs. They built the national parks. They did all these things. Yeah, and all of these triumphs were due to economic anxiety, if you will, economic discontent, and so that's like a I want to say that's a pretty well-known chapter of American history. And Meacham basically doesn't talk about it, or he talks about it in the vaguest of terms, just sort of smooths by it, doesn't really talk about it. And the great example of this, I mean, it's kind of a shocking example, is in that songbook that you mentioned. And I was sort of flipping through the songbook, and he has his representative song of the Great Depression is appropriate. It's Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, which really was the anthem. I could sing it for you, but I'm not going to, which really was the anthem of the early 1930s. Studs Terkel writes about this in his classic book about the 1930s. It's called Hard Times. He has a chapter just called The Song, where people talk about their reactions to that song, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And so, of course, that's the one that Meacham includes as the song from the Depression. And he mentions, what the Depression was. It was a time of unemployment. And then there's an illustration, a visual illustration for the song. The illustration is illustrating bread lines, you know, that there were, in fact, bread lines during the 1930s. Now, this kind of blew my mind when I found it. The illustration that he uses is from an old bank advertisement. A sort of trade association for banks put out these posters in, I think, the 1920s, and this one is called the Breadline. And this is, you can read the text in the ad. And again, this is being used as an illustration of the Depression, okay, in Meacham's book. This is the text in the ad. Now, Meacham himself didn't write this. It comes from an ad in the 1920s, as far as I can tell. But here's what it says. There are periods of depression and periods of prosperity, but unfortunately, there is always a bread line for those who haven't learned to save. Yes.
Oh,
yeah. Wait, Violet, it goes on.
No.
During prosperity, you must save if you are to bridge the periods of depression. Can you believe that shit? In the year, whatever this year is, whenever that book was published, 2019 or whatever. That's how he chooses to illustrate the Great Depression, that a bank advertisement blaming the poor for their own fate because they didn't save. Now, again, he didn't write those words. That's from a bank advertisement from long ago. But to include such a absolutely thoughtless, I mean, he is the author of the book, you know, and so the buck stops with him, to quote one of my favorite presidents. And then if you watch the HBO documentary, he does talk about the Depression a little bit, and he blames it on, he mentions two factors. One of them is tariffs, which is a common, you know, I used to work at the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal always, whenever they have to talk about the Great Depression, they blame it on tariffs, you know, on the Holly Smoot tariff and stuff like that. This is a standard sort of talking point on the free market. Right. But Meacham also blames it on immigration quotas. Okay, that is totally novel. I have never heard of that before. And it's like he's blaming it on Trumpism, avant la lettre, right? Because these are things, Trump is upset about immigration, and Trump is upset about trade agreements. And so he finds these two factors at work in the 30s. And anyhow, it's a totally novel theory of the Great Depression. I've never heard anybody make that argument before.
Yeah, especially anybody who lived through it.
But he did not, of course.
And you did not. No, but I mean, like, if you read Hard Times, you get this real, it's an incredible book.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I Studs Terkel is really, well, he's dead now. He was a great man. He was a friend of mine, by the way, when I lived in Chicago. one of the true greats.
Yeah, really. I mean, really. And that book, it encapsulates so many different experiences from people who are just like, yeah, we just sat on our porch, to people who really struggled, to, I mean, the one speaker in the book that always sticks out in my mind is the photographer who just did society photos in New York. And he says something like, well, I never saw any people in bread lines. You know, I was with the beautiful ladies. And it's like, you really can live through a desperate time where everyone is suffering. And if you're not keeping your eyes open, and if you're not taking the time to sort of get out of your bubble, and I don't mean that in a like racist Trump voter bubble, I mean that in terms of like looking, you know, being interested in the world. Yeah. You can miss the Great Depression, and it's really sick.
Hey, Violet.
Yes.
We missed the opioid epidemic.
We did.
I don't mean you and me personally. I mean members of the media bubble missed it,
right.
until it was basically. I first time I even heard about it was in, and this is because I am a part of that liberal media bubble, and I live in Bethesda, Maryland, and I read the Washington Post, and I had heard very, very little about it before 2016. And it is possible. I mean, just think about that for a second. That went on for years. And, you know, with a huge body count, you know, a huge death toll, and people didn't know it was happening. Think about this. There's this book, Deaths of Despair, which I've been reading, and that's kind of brought this home to me. It's so shocking and horrible that the American life expectancy was actually going in reverse in the late Obama years. And we didn't know about it. Okay, that's like, that indicates catastrophe on a society-wide scale. And we don't know what's going on. How freaky is that? Now, a lot of that is because of the what we talked about earlier, which is the death of journalism outside of the big cities, outside of New York and Washington. And so we don't read, you know, newspapers from, you know, middle-sized cities in Iowa or Ohio anymore. We don't even know about these stories. Oh my God, this is depressing. But anyhow, I don't know why I went off on that tangent. It's just like you talk about people living through the Depression and not knowing it was happening. There is something very familiar about that right now.
Exactly. No, yeah, that's why I mentioned it, because it is sometimes, I mean, you can miss it if you're not paying attention, but also resources aren't there to let you know, but please continue.
Yes, exactly. But one last point about Meacham, which is when he's talking about these, he massively inflates the role of certain organizations in American life. And I don't just mean the Klan. The Klan was a big part of the sort of history of the 1920s. And it's important to take that into account. But when he's talking about the 1930s, in the HBO documentary, like he never really talks about the rise of organized labor. In the 30s was this great moment for worker organizing. There's a group called the CIO that just took America by storm, was organizing the automobile industry, was organizing the steel industry, was organizing the rubber industry. It was, you know, going from victory to victory all through the 1930s. I mean, it is a great, great moment for not just labor, but for liberalism. The CIO is militantly anti-racist. You know, it's a great movement, right? It's the kind of thing that a historian like Meacham should be celebrating, but he doesn't talk about that. Instead, he talks about the German-American Bund, which is a Nazi organization that was mainly in New York City. I don't know how big it was, but not very big, right? It never had much of an effect. I mean, they're memorable because there's a lot of footage of them, and these are like Americans dressed in Nazi uniforms. You know, it's so mind blowing. It's so crazy. But he talks about that in this is in the HBO documentary, as though that's an important part of the Depression. As though that's an important part of what's going on in the 1930s, right? And
it's important to Henry Ford.
Oh yeah, no, look, there are assholes in American life. There are anti-Semites in American life. There's no doubt about that. But there's a whole I don't want to get into this too deep, but there's this sense that so many, and this is not Meacham alone, this is basically everybody who writes about the 1930s now talks about how, you know, Roosevelt was beset by the sort of this racist right and this communist left. And Roosevelt was, you know, and then these kind of Huey Long demagogue types, Father Coughlin, people like that. And that Roosevelt, you know, Roosevelt stuck to the middle, and Roosevelt was, as a result, they depict Roosevelt as being this great centrist who staved off fascism in America. And I am here to tell you, you know, that is not really what happened in the 1930s. The great threat to Roosevelt was not the German American Bund. Okay. Huey Long was for real, but he died before he ever really got going. The real threat to Roosevelt was a group called the American Liberty League. This was the original granddaddy of all right-wing front groups. Was set up by the DuPont family, who were the Koch brothers of their day. They were brothers, and they were the richest family in America at the time. And they bankrolled this group. This is before there were any limitations on this kind of spending in America. And
well, there's not going to be any more soon.
No, it's we're
please continue. We're going back.
We're right back to where they were, and this is in the mid 30s. And they bankrolled this group, and they had more money than the Republican Party, and they opposed Roosevelt with everything they had. And it was all, I mean, Roosevelt was opposed by something like 85% of the editorial pages in America. The wealthy were against him. The law professors were against him. The economists were against him. And these people blanketed the country with their denunciations of Roosevelt, calling him a dictator, calling him a fascist, calling him a communist. And he beat their ass. And that's the real, the great sort of story of the 1930s. And somehow that is not, nobody tells that story, because when you do actually study that, Roosevelt beat them by, you know, Roosevelt was on the left. This is just, it is so hard for people to understand today, but believe me, Roosevelt was a liberal. And the way he beat these guys was by speaking to people's, economic anxiety, talking about, he called these people economic royalists. You know, he was very good at fighting these people, and he just beat the hell out of them. And that's the real dynamic of the 1930s, not this kind of, the Nazis were going to take over or something.
Right. And I mean, I think that goes back to Meacham's personal connection to Biden, and to a further extent, the role of former political advisors and or politicians like Rahm Emanuel or, you know, Chris Christie. Who
I think it's even more blunt than that. I mean, the American Liberty League is basically Reaganism.
Right,
and it's what we call neoliberalism. This was Roosevelt was regarded as at the time as a radical, because he had taken America off the gold standard. He was regulating industry. He was supporting the unemployed. You know, we got unemployment insurance for the first time. Social Security. All of these things were massive offenses against economic propriety, against orthodox classical economics. I mean, these are you can't imagine what the New Deal looked like to people who believed in classical economics. This is norm shattering, earth shaking. It's like Lenin, you know, it's that shocking to these people. Well, these people are what we today call neoliberalism. And that comes back into power with Ronald Reagan. John Meacham admires Ronald Reagan above all other presidents.
Yes, they say this in the documentary. They love him.
So of course he's not going to see that as an important dynamic in American life. That's who he is.
Exactly. Yes. And all the, you know, I mean, we were referring to this before, but that, you know, all the ills of all the bad things about America that we can all agree on, welfare queen is not one of them.
Yeah,
the ills of the Reagan administration, ignoring the AIDS crisis, these very serious
destroying organized labor, you know, and the NAFTA, for God's sakes, although that was Bush, you know, his hero. Yeah, these are not bad things for him. The only twist here is that Meacham is the people who adore him are liberals.
Yeah, it's true.
That's the twist. Everything else is totally predictable and normal.
I mean, this is when you get this type of commentator, you know, and I remember this again because this was like 9 months ago? People were talking about how, you know, oh, we need a Republican like Ronald Reagan again and not somebody like Donald Trump.
That Trump was that.
Exactly.
I don't know why that is so hard. Make America great again. That's a Reagan slogan.
Well, yeah, literally, Roger Stone came up with that in 1979, and then he used it again for that campaign. Like, it all just comes back around. But it is worrying because, again, these popular histories, sure, they change depending on who's telling them, what year they're in, but they do have an effect on our common understanding of the past is, and again, they can be really damaging and erase things that are hugely important and what actually happened.
You're right about that, but I would historicize, I would use a little historicism here, that he is a product of these times rather than the moving force.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This was very spirited, which is good.
Thank you for having me, Violet.
You've been listening to the Harper's Magazine podcast, produced by Violet Luca and Andrew Blevins. The music is Cut and Shoot by Febrifuge. Harper's Magazine is the oldest general interest monthly in America, exploring the issues that drive our national conversation through long-form narrative journalism and essays. To get 12 issues for $21.97, visit harpers.org/save.